Luke chapter 14, Jesus is at this point traveling around the area of Perea and Judea. He's only weeks from crucifixion, going into Jerusalem. That's what he's awaiting, to go into Jerusalem where he'll be arrested, where he will be taking up his cross, be beaten, and sacrificed for you and I, for our salvations. While he's doing this, he's going into some synagogues and he's speaking. He's teaching publicly in public places. He's still driving out demons and he's still healing people. So this is the perspective and the scenario of where we are. So let's take a look at that first verse that I want to look at in 14:1. And it says there, it says, on one Sabbath. Now, when we see Sabbath, we say, uh-oh. Because Jesus had he just despised what they had done with God's Sabbath. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a what? Of a prominent Pharisee. Now, we've never seen this before. This is a prominent Pharisee. He was being carefully watched. Now, Luke talks a lot about Jesus eating. Not that he ate so much, but that he ate a lot with people. This was a way that he engaged with people in an engaging way. Some of the best teachings that we get from Jesus is while he's eating, and he was a non-discriminatory eater. He would eat with anybody, anytime, anywhere. I mean, he would go to a sinner's house and eat, or he would go to a Pharisee's house and eat. He just liked to eat with people. And I was thinking about that. You know, isn't it fun when we get together just to eat? I mean, you know, some of my best memories and best moments are when I've taken time and just eaten with people. But you would think, wouldn't you, that these people would learn that, wouldn't you, don't invite him to your house to eat. It's not going to be good. You know, it doesn't come out well. And the last time that we studied him doing it, it was really bad. But they didn't, and they earned. And this was not just a Pharisee. This wasn't a regular Pharisee. This was what a prominent, you know, Pharisee. You know, you've met religious people. Then there are religious people, but there are religious people. I mean, there are prominent, dominant religious people, right? And when you get around them, they dominate everything. They dominate what you eat. They dominate what you drink. They dominate what you say. They dominate what you do. And this is kind of the session here. This is kind of the setting. This is a prominent Pharisee. And Pharisees in general felt like they were the keeper of the truth. And Jesus really came against that. Jesus says, no, I'm the truth. I'm the life and I'm the way, right? And they were the ones who said, we're the presence of God's righteousness. You know, we're the essence. We're the perspective of God's righteousness. If you want to see how God wants you to be righteous and what God wants you to do and what God wants you to say and how God wants you to live, look at us. And Jesus said, no. If you looked at me, if you've seen me, then you've seen the Father. You've seen righteousness. And they said, no, we're the ones who are really devout. We're the ones who are really serious about God, you know. Jesus said, no, you're a bunch of hypocrites. you guys just play a game. You don't really have a relationship with God. You're just doing this. Jesus said, you're blind. You know, if blind leads the blind, what happens? It's all falling into ditch, you know. And that's what Jesus said, and he said these things publicly. He said, you know what, you're a bunch of snakes. You're just a bunch of vipers, and you're a generation. Your daddy was a viper. Your children are vipers. You're just a bunch of poisonous people. And he says, you know, that's what you are. You're sons of hell. You're not sons of righteousness. You're not sons of God. You're sons of hell. And you make people twice the sons of hell that you are. And that's what Jesus was saying about it. And so how do these two get together? I mean, why do you invite somebody to eat with you that you know doesn't like you and that you don't like? Well, so, you know, I'm looking at this thing and I'm thinking, why? So it's fascinating to me. First of all, why did the Pharisee invite Jesus? And it's even more fascinating to me, why did Jesus go? You know, it's a combination of oil and water. It won't mix. It's a combination of gas and fire. We're going to have an explosion here. You know, and you're just thinking about that. Why is this going on? So we kind of see why they invited Jesus as they were watching him carefully. And I want you to see this word in the Greek, this word that this is translated as, carefully watched him. And what this word means is to stand beside and watch. I mean, they were up close and personal. They were watching to see what he did, watching to see if he had some magic tricks. I guess they were watching to see what he said, hear what he said. So they were watching him up close and personal to watch assiduously. That means they were watching him constantly. They were unlimitlessly. It's 24/7. They're watching Jesus. And they also, it means to watch insidiously, which means there was an evil intent it wasn't a good thing that they were wanting to see. They were wanting to see something insidious going on, and they were watching scrupulously. What we would say is he was under a microscope. You know, that's what it was. Have you ever felt like that? You ever felt like you were under a microscope? You know, being watched. I have. Yeah. And it is not a fun place to be. And I certainly don't want to go to somebody's house that does that, you know? So why? We kind of see why they were inviting him so they could watch him, but why'd he go? You know, this is fascinating to me. So let's see how this rolls out and what is said here. Let's look at this passage. I'll read it out of mine so we can get through. Okay. There, in front of him, in front of Jesus, was a man suffering from dropsy. And Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Did everybody there know the answer to this question? Did Jesus know? Who are there are the Pharisees and the experts in the law. Did everybody there know the answer to this question? So is it lawful or not on the Sabbath? So, but they what? They remain silent. There's your title for today. And what I want you to do is say that back to me. They remain silent. Would you say that back? They remain silent. Why? If the Sabbath is such a big deal, and all you've got here are Pharisees and teachers of why? Why do they remain silent? What's this about? Okay. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him away. This is fascinating. Because Jesus isn't provoking a fight here. The last time that we looked at him in Luke 11, he provoked those people. Remember, he didn't wash his hands like they wanted him to. And he provoked them into a fight. And they come out with six woes unto you. You know, damn you to hell is what woe means. And it wasn't good. But here he doesn't seem to be doing that. He's here kind of in a different mode. Now, this dropsy thing. Dropsy is the retention of water in the body. We've all seen people with congestive heart failure. And we know what happens when a person has congestive heart failure. Their circulation doesn't work. Their body swells. Maybe kidney failure. In kidney failure, no dialysis back then. And so what would happen is the system, the whole body would become poisoned because there was no excretion of fluids. And so the whole body would swell up and become very tender and sensitive. And then maybe it was a liver failure. You know, liver failure works the same way. The liver's not filtering the blood, and so the liquids remain in there, and the swelling again, and coloration of the skin and so forth takes place. So this guy's in bad shape. This guy's in dire condition here. He doesn't have long to live. Is the thought. So I was thinking about that. You know, now why is he there? Because he would be classified as unclean. Right, he would be in their system. He would look as though he was an infectious person, and he should be classified as unclean and not be there. But he's there. Why is he there? Is he a plant? Well, why would you bring somebody who would make everything and everyone unclean into your party? You know, why do that? If he's unclean, then he's going to make every person there, and this prominent Pharisee, he's going to make him unclean. He's going to make all the other Pharisees and teachers and experts in the law, they're going to be unclean. Everybody's going to be unclean. So you know, does it make sense that you would plant somebody that's going to spoil everything and make everything unclean? The house is unclean. Everybody's in there is unclean. So it's, what else could this be? Well, I think it's a friend. And I think it's somebody that these Pharisees and these experts in the law liked. It was a friend. It was somebody they appreciated. They loved. They wanted to be around. Even as sick as he was, they wanted him to be a part of this time with this rabbi, Jesus. And so I think that's what he was. And it seems that when I put it into that perspective, that the whole light changed on this whole story. Everything about it changes when you see this person more as a person that they liked, a person that they cared for and they loved, rather than it being a plant. Okay, so it's interesting. It says that he is sitting right in front of Jesus, right? So there he is. Jesus can't help but see. Now, usually when Jesus would heal somebody, what Jesus would do is he'd just call him up and heal him. You remember when he healed that woman that was bent over double, right, for 18 years? He didn't ask anybody if he could heal her. He didn't care. He just called her forward. And he said, woman, you are loosed or freed from your infirmities. And he put his hands on her and she popped up like that jack-in-the-box, remember? So we understand Jesus, this is different. This is different. Why? Why did he ask? It's like he's kind of asking permission here if he can heal. And it's an unusual question, not in that he hasn't said it before. And it's unusual into whom he's asking this question. And here's the question that he asked. He said, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? And it says, and they remain silent. Why? 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 You see, it's so interesting to me, because when I looked at it in this perspective, I'm thinking, well, you know, what he was really saying is, listen, guys, we can do it either way. We can heal or not. You know, it's kind of up to you. Is it lawful for me to do this or is it not? It's like he's kind of asking permission. And they remained silent. Why? Because when it's your friend, because when it's somebody you love, when it's your child, when it's your relative, when it's somebody you love and really care about, everything changes. You bend laws. You break rules. Right? You're not nearly as condemning when it's somebody you love or when it's you. When it's that other person, or that other person's kids, or that person that messed up, we can be so condemning and so judgmental when it's somebody else and somebody we don't love. But when it's somebody we love and we care about, man, everything has a new light and a new perspective. See, our whole foundations kind of change around when it's somebody that we love and that we care about. We're so much more forgiving when it's us or somebody that we love. Am I right? I was thinking about that. You know, I see that in this lesson here. Here's their friend, their somebody that they care about, somebody that's very, very sick. The Sabbath no longer matters now. When we're like that with somebody that we love, we care, I don't care what they do, we're so much more forgiving. We're so much more loving and so less condemning. And what we need to learn from this is that the next time we catch ourselves condemning, the next time we find ourselves judging, the next time we find ourselves in a bad state of mind, we need to say, well, what if that were me? What if that were my child? What if that were my best friend? Would I be so condemning? Or would I be more forgiving? Don't you think that's what Jesus would really want all of us to do every time? So we want to draw that from that particular story. This is the first thing that I want you to know. And the first thing I want you to get a hold on right there is that we've got to be more forgiving and more loving and less condemning and less judgmental. And then Jesus did something different here. He healed in a way that's nowhere else is mentioned in the scriptures that I'm aware of. He healed this guy in a different way. I want you to see this word. So put the word up there for me where he laid hold of him. He's taken hold of him. Now what this word means is seized him. Now, usually, you know, Jesus lay hands on somebody or you just speak it or something. But this actually, it means seize upon anything with the hands and lay hold of. We can take it down. Now, so what Jesus did is he got up and he went around to this guy wherever he was. And he grabbed this guy and kind of hugged him, I guess. Now, you have to realize this guy was swollen. He was tender. He was sensitive. But Jesus grabs him and hugs him. And so what I'm saying is, you know, Jesus is always healing people differently. You know, we kind of get it in our heads how we're going to be healed. You know, that he might want to spit on your eyes. He might want to put mud in there. Is that okay with me if I need the healing, right? All right, one time, you know, he spit in his hand and put it on somebody else's tongue. Yeah, but hey, spit on me. Come on. You remember Naaman? He had to go and dip in the Jordan 7 times to get his healing. He didn't want to do that. We get it so figured out sometimes of how the healing's got to happen. No. Jesus just hugged me, squeezed me, spit on me, whatever, dump me in the pool of Bethesda, whatever I got to do. But stay open to your healing. When you need healing, just say, Lord, however, just here I am. Hug me, squeeze me, spit on me, whatever you want to do, Lord. I'm good for that. And so I see that. So I wanted to bring that particular part out too. But then I want to look at this next verse here quickly in verse 5. It says, then he asked them, if one of you has a son or an ox and that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull them out? And what did they say? And they had... nothing to say. Now, were they giving him the silent treatment, or, you know, what's going on here? You know, they just seen their good buddy healed, and, you know, and, well, so what's happening? Well, what do you say about that? I mean, well, if your ox falls in, or if your child falls in a well, what do you do? Do you wait till the Sabbath pass, or do you pull him out right then? You know? They have nothing to say. They're letting him talk. They're letting him make his points. They're letting him come across. And in that day, there was wells everywhere. They didn't have a spigot like we do and turn a spigot on and get water any place you go. They had to dig wells, and wells were everywhere. And I mean, animals were falling in them. People were falling in them. And then so Jesus said, this guy's, you know, you don't let your animal or your child drown in a well waiting for the Sabbath to pass. You get them out immediately, right? Same way with this guy. This guy's drowning in his own fluid. We going to wait? We going to wait? No. Let's get him out immediately. So Jesus heals this guy. And so I'm looking at this, you know. Well, there's no, Jesus, they're not offended by what he's done. They're not coming against it. He's not coming against them. He's not woeing them. You know, he's not blasting them. They're not blasting him. They're letting him talk. They're not refuting what he's saying. I'm thinking, this is kind of different. This is a different Pharisee deal, you know. I'm thinking. So Jesus sort of pushes the envelope just a little bit more. And he gets into another point that I want to bring out. So let's look at this one. Luke 14:7. It says when he noticed how the guest picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. Now, remember, the parable is you lay alongside. That parable means to lay alongside. So he's laying out this story, and they and we are to lay ourselves alongside of it and find ourselves in it. That's what we're looking at here. So this is supposed to be a parable. He says, when someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. And if so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this man your seat. Then, humiliated. Have you ever been humiliated? I have. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place. Take the what? Take the lowest place, the lowest seat. So that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you'll be honored. And in the presence of all your fellow guests. For, here's why you do this. Everyone who exalts who? Himself. Will be humbled. And he who humbles who? Himself will be exalted. Now, it seems like more of a parable than it's a lesson in etiquette, right? But Jesus really isn't talking about forks, knives, and spoons and placements. He's giving us a lesson in humility. And this is what happens in these settings. This is one of the best teachings of humility that he's ever given. And you know, it's just so powerful and so strong when you really see it as such. But Jesus spins this thing, you know. He spins it into a lesson in humility. What he's doing is he's watching these Pharisees and these experts in the law jockeying around for seats. At a table, and basically what this is would be sort of a round table. It would only be very, very high, and they would either cross their legs and squat and sit there, or they would stretch out with their feet away from the table. And the person that was of most importance, and probably in this case this dominant Pharisee, he was probably the person there, and probably Jesus was to his right as he was the guest, and then to his left would be the next important person, and then next to Jesus would be the next important person, and then over here would be the next important person, and on and on and on. And the furthest away from the most important person, this dominant Pharisee at this particular time probably, would be the seat of least importance, the place where the least important person would sit. Nobody wanted to sit there. And everybody was avoiding that, and they were jockeying around trying to find a better place, better seat. And Jesus says, no, you're missing it. You're missing it. That's where you want to sit. That's the best place, because if you'll sit there, you'll be exalted. But if you try to sit in one of these other places, what's going to happen is you could be asked to move. You know, it's a lesson in humility. We have a difficult time understanding humility, I think, in our minds. See, we kind of think that humility is degrading ourselves, is berating ourselves, is belittling ourselves. It's kind of like, you know, we think that we're being asked to be a worm or something when we're being asked to be humble. That's not it at all. Several years back, we had this men's retreat, and we went to it. A bunch of you, some of you that went with us, and we were in this one meeting, and this guy started calling all of us men worms, or actually, I think Doug, didn't he say maggots? Isn't that what? Maggots, that's what it was. He's saying we're maggots. And this is grating on me, because I am not a maggot. I am a child of the Most High God, and you know, and I am not a maggot. And that was grating on me, and I was going to be the speaker the next day. And I could not wait, because I was going to tell, you're not a maggot. You know, and I did. I come against that thing, because we are children of the Most High God. You are important. You're a child of God. You are extremely important in the kingdom of God. You're not a worm. You're not a maggot. So how do you balance this importance aspect of your life and who you are with this humility thing? This is what we're after. So I think we struggle here. And so C.S. Lewis has had this neat quote, and I want to show it to you. C.S. Lewis said this: true humility is not thinking less of yourself; it's thinking of yourself less. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I like that statement. It's cute. Good. It's powerful. But I don't think that sums up what Jesus is trying to get across here to us. Several years back, I have a couple of examples in there for you, but this is one Judy reminded me of last night. Lance was out in OKC in Oklahoma City. He was out working with Craig Rochelle, and so they were flying to Atlanta to a church, big church, for Craig to speak in. And so Lance called us and said, we're going to be in Atlanta. Told us where they're going to be. This really nice facility, big church. And we wanted to know if we wanted to come. We said, sure. So we drove down. We got there early. And so we go in, and really nobody there. It's an amazing facility. We go in, I guess, what, seven rows or so back? I don't know, six, seven rows back. We sat down. You know, we just sat down. That's what you do in church, you know, you sit down. So we were there just a few minutes, and this little guy comes up, and he says, you're going to have to move. Okay, why? Well, this is where the deacon sat. Okay. We did. We just, okay, fine. You know, no big deal to me. But we were moved from where we were. We didn't realize we were in a place of importance. We moved back. So we go back. We sit down. Well, Lance comes and finds us, and he takes us to the back, to the green room, where they entertain the speakers, and all the leadership was always back there. And so we're waiting. They start praise and worship, and we're waiting to go out. And so we come out in the parade. I mean, we come out with the big people, you know, with the big shots. We're coming out, and we sit on the front row. We're right there on the front row. Well, this little guy's eyes got about that big. And he's looking, and boy, you know, so we're on the front row. And so after the service was over, he comes running up to Judy, and he says, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I didn't know, you should have told me, you should have. No, it's no big deal, it's no big deal, you know, it's no big deal. But it was just an example of, you know, okay, no big deal, no, I'm not, I didn't stand up and say, hey, listen, you don't know who I am, I we didn't do all that, we just, okay, you know, it's cool, I didn't know. So anyway, it was just, and so there's some principles here. And I have an example for you in there. That one time I was invited to something that was a fundraiser, if I remember correctly, and I was in textiles, and anyway I was seated with the congressman, and this guy, he was loving himself, man. He was somebody. He wanted us to know he was somebody. And he was pulling and really commanding responses from us, summoning responses from us about how important and all the things he had done in Congress and making a big deal of himself. And I enjoyed, you know, being around that and listening to the things that I don't get to hear a lot. And that part was fun. But I remember thinking, you know, man, you sure are loving yourself. And it wasn't long after that, this waitress, this server, spilled a plate of food in his lap. And he was the big wheel there that day. But I was thinking, you know, well, I started learning something then. That whenever we start, you know, aggrandizing ourselves and so showing how people, how big we are and how important we are, you know, something's about to happen. And he was nearly voted out the next term, but he kept talking about all of the great things he did. And he didn't even run the next term because he was so far behind in the polls. See, when you aggrandize yourself, a lot of times you'll be voted out. You will. I love what Winston Churchill said, and I want to read that to you here as well. This is one of the favorite things that I saw. Winston Churchill was once asked, doesn't it thrill you to know that every time you make a speech, the hall is packed to overflowing? It's quite flattering, replied Sir Winston. But whenever I feel that way, I always remember that if instead of making a political speech, I was being hanged, the crowd would be twice as big. Isn't that the truth? People will turn out for a hanging, man. I'm telling you. They will come out. And I've learned over my years of ministry, it's when these things happen, you know, you got to learn from them. What I saw here, it was what Jesus was trying to get across to us. When we don't sit in that humility seat, and we want to be important, then what happens is God is going to get involved in it. Because one moment Jesus is talking about this host, this person at this wedding, humiliating the other person. And then in the next moment, it's like he's bringing God into it. He who humbles himself will be exalted, and he who exalts himself will be humbled. And so he's like bringing this deep truth into it. And isn't that exactly what Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18 says? Let's take a look at that in Proverbs. It says, pride goes before destruction. Is that right? I mean, that's what it says. And a haughty spirit before a fall. What I've learned is that every time that I have been humiliated, if I will not get mad at the host who's changing my seat and dressing me down, if I'll not get to that, and I'll look to find where God's in it, I'll find out what God is trying to do is keep me from destroying myself. What God is trying to do is keep me from making a fall of my life and destroying myself. And I think if you'll take the times of humiliation that you've had in your life as well, and you will really look at them. I know you got mad at the person who humiliated. I know, I did. But when you really sit back and look at it, God's attempting to do something in our lives that we can't see. We see ourselves as, well, I'm too important to be humiliated. No, you're not. In fact, it's when you think you're important that you will be humiliated. So we shouldn't seek after the things and and applauds and accolades of people. What we need to really realize is that when we start getting those, we need to take it as a warning. And I've learned to do that. The people who have given me the greatest flattering remarks and greatest accolades would hang me today if they could. They would vote me out if we voted. See, and so what Jesus is saying here, I've learned, and I love to know that I've said something that ministers to you, but man, I've come to look at that as a warning. Delbert, set in the humility seat. Sit down. You're not that good. Sit down. Don't look for the accolades of people. Find the smile of God, and the smile of God is in the seat of humility. So that's the second thing that I want you to know in here. And here's the third one. We'll wind this up, this particular point, in verse 12. So then Jesus said to his host, now this would have been the prominent Pharisee, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends. What? Why am I giving it? I mean, what? Who does that? Who pitches a party and don't invite the friends? Are your brothers or relatives? Wait a minute. I love my family. Are your rich neighbors? Now, I have a couple of rich neighbors, but most folks, you know, I like them. And you know, why? What is going on here? Don't do that. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. Yeah, that's why I'm doing it, right? Part of it, you know. I want to be, you know, a part of this. You know? And so he goes on and says, but when you give a banquet, a party, whatever, invite the poor, the crippled, and the lame, and the blind. In other words, invite people that you really don't have anything in common with. Invite people that you really don't like to hang out with and really doesn't like to hang out with you. Invite people that you just don't want to be around. That's who you really invite. That doesn't make any sense. And he says, and you will be what? Blessed. So we can be repaid by man or blessed by God. Which do I want? Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid. Now look at this. At the what? At the resurrection. What's the resurrection got to do with this? At the resurrection of the righteous. Now aren't you glad that nobody today only invites to their parties people, their friends, and people they want to be around? That people today, well, who we invite to our parties and our banquets and our stuff, are people that we don't want to be around. people that we're not, don't have anything in common with, people that don't want to be around us. That's who we invite today, right, to our parties and our banquets. Have we changed a bit in the 2,000 years since Jesus said and taught this? I was thinking about that. I think we're worse. I do. I mean, we can go for weeks or months or maybe years. We're never having any communication with people. We've got our cell phones. We've got our computers. We've got the internet. We don't need anybody. We're islands. We've gone backwards in this. We don't understand what the point is and what the... have you ever done that? Have you ever had a party for the sole purpose and intent of inviting people to it that you really don't want to be around or don't want to be around you or that you have nothing in common with? Have you ever done that? I haven't. But Jesus says, by doing that, you'll be blessed by God. And here's the kicker. Not only will we be blessed by God now, but it's got something to do with my resurrection, with your resurrection. What? What? And so as I was evaluating myself with this passage, I'm thinking, first of all, I was shaken. And then secondly of all, I was ashamed. I was ashamed because of the few times in my life that I've ever done that. I've ever done something for someone, expecting nothing in return. Done something for someone who I knew could never repay me back. There's a few times, probably could count them on my hand if I could even remember them, that I've really done that. I was shaken because of its link, the connection with my blessings in life, and its connection with my resurrection. I don't want to miss the resurrection. I want to make sure of that, right? And I want God to bless my life. Why is it that we, everything that we do in life, it becomes like we're going to use it for leverage? You know, is there anything wrong with having your friends over and doing nice things for your friends? Is there anything wrong with that? No, but basically, why are they your friends? Basically because you've done something for them, or they've done something for you, or they've invited you and you repay back, and... And we leverage people. People become projects in our lives. I was pondering that, you know, people do things for God. Are they leveraging God? They think they're leveraging God? Has God become a project to so many people today? Because we don't understand this principle. So what we got to learn is how we can really do this right. We can assure our resurrection by doing nice things for people with no ulterior motive. Doing things for people that we know can never, ever, in no way repay us back. That's what we need to learn from this. Right? That's what we need to learn from this. So what are the three things that I really want you to know, and the three things that I really want you to do? Number one, don't judge people. When you start finding yourself condemning and judging people, then you got to put it into perspective of you know, what if I was that person that I'm judging, or what if my child was this person that I'm judging, or what if my best friend was this person that I'm judging? It's going to change how we look at things. And we're going to be way more forgiving. And we're going to get the smile of God. And the second thing that I want you to know is don't aggrandize yourself. Make sure you sit in that seat of humility. And if you find yourself being humiliated, stop. Don't get mad at the person who's humiliated you. Find God in there somewhere. Because what God's trying to do is keep you from destroying yourself. Keep you from having a fall. By sitting in the seat of humility, you'll get the smile of God. The third thing that I want you to know, and the third thing that I want you to go out of here with today, is we've got to get to a place where we do things for people, not for repayment and reciprocation, but we do things for people just because we want to bless them. We don't want something back in return. Let's read that verse one more time. Closing. Verse 14. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Probably this week, every single one of us is going to have an opportunity to encounter someone who needs something, who can't repay us back. Don't miss your opportunity to make God smile. Don't miss an opportunity to get blessed. And make sure you assure your resurrection. Is that good? Let's pray. Father,